The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed what he called the arrogant, high-handed, unjust, and erroneous rhetoric of the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal toward the Islamic Republic. Ayatollah Khamenei also denounced Britain, France, and Germany for failing to comply with their commitments under the nuclear agreement. The leader also lashed out at Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has repeatedly accused Iran of trying to acquire nuclear weapons. The leader added that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure and will not back down on its logical stance on its nuclear program. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei referred to a law passed by the Iranian parliament in late December that requires the government to take additional action to reduce commitments to the nuclear deal, which includes a decision to end the voluntary implementation of additional protocol. The leader said Iran will develop its nuclear capabilities in line with the needs of the country, and for this reason, Iran's enrichment purity level will not be limited to 20%. He said Tehran may increase the level to 60% if it deems necessary.
We should remember that the framework around this whole thing here is that a number of nuclear powers are sitting telling what Iran should do, which is not a nuclear power, while other nuclear powers are not even discussed.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear agreement and its reimposition of sanctions in May 2018, Tehran exercised patience and remained fully committed to its obligations under the accord. However, a year later, Iran started to reduce its commitments in 5 gradual steps every 60 days, citing the failure of the European signatories to the JCPOA to uphold their end of the deal. In the meantime, Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, said on Monday that Tehran has terminated the voluntary implementation of additional protocol, which allowed snap inspections of Iranian nuclear sites. On Sunday, Iran and the UN nuclear watchdog reached an agreement for the continued inspection of Iranian nuclear sites for 3 months. Gharibabadi said Iran would record information at certain nuclear facilities without the supervision of the inspectors, as per the new agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has recently expressed willingness to participate in an informal JCPOA meeting with Iran and other signatories. It has offered to hold talks with Iran over how to return to the deal. This is why Iranian officials have repeatedly and unequivocally rejected any preconditions or talks on the U.S. return to the deal, arguing that it was the U.S. that abandoned the accord and violated the U.N. Security Council 2231 that endorsed the multilateral agreement. Tehran says it will reverse its scalebacks to its commitments under the deal once all sanctions are lifted and all the signatories go back to full compliance.
After weeks of negotiating in Amman, the head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners' Affairs says the talks have ended without making any progress due to the inflexible approach of the delegation of former government backed by Saudi Arabia. The committee says it has made several proposals to overcome the differences, all in vain.
There are many reasons that caused the failure of the negotiations, including that the other party presented new names that did not exist before and changed the list that was agreed upon. Another reason is that the Islam Party, one of the parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition, wants to free its members only. A third reason is that they don't have one delegation to negotiate, but rather multiple delegations representing different parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition.
A member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, described the Saudi-backed delegation's refusal of swap deals as a crime. He said the failure of talks is a message from Saudi Arabia and its allies that they are not serious about any solution that may end the suffering of the Yemenis. He said their calls for peace are not in line with any real action. More than 15,000 Yemenis were captured in battle fronts by both warring sides since the beginning of the war in March 2015. Of these prisoners, only more than 1,000 were released in 2020 under a UN brokered deal, while hundreds of others have been freed through local negotiations.
The release of thousands of Yemenis from Saudi prisons needs more efforts by the United Nations to pressure the representatives of the former government and the Saudi-led coalition to stop hampering the swaps. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As the coronavirus resurges in Iran, domestic biotech firms are in a race against time to get a vaccine to the market. Among the 8 viable candidates, Coviran is now ahead in the race. Produced by the headquarters for executing Imam Khomeini's order, The vaccine started its first phase of the human trials in December last year. And now, as developers say, the first step was a success.
The first phase was to test whether or not the vaccine is safe to be injected to everyone. So we inoculated 56 volunteers in two stages, and the good news is no one has displayed any serious side effect as a result of the jabs.
Two more phases are left for the vaccine to get the ultimate approval. In the second phase, 400 volunteers will get the jabs. This time, the aim is to assess how much immunity the vaccine will make against the virus.
In the second phase, we are going to have something like 400 people, 100 between 50 and 75, the average of the age, and the other 300 above 18 and until 50. If we could, we will get emergency permit like other vaccines to combine phase 2 and 3.
While the UK variant of the coronavirus has reached Iran, experts say the Iranian vaccine is effective against the mutated virus.
This vaccine is whole virus that is inactivated. And that's why if there is any more mutation in the virus, this whole virus vaccines may be more effective than those that have just a simple antigen or whatever.
Earlier this month, Iran unveiled another homegrown vaccine dubbed COVPARS, which is now undergoing the first phase of the human trials. Administered through injection and inhalation, COVPARS is an mRNA recombinant vaccine that reconstructs a harmless piece of the virus's spike protein. The second batch of Russia's Sputnik V arrived in Iran last week amid an ongoing voluntary vaccination in the country. Iran's government says it does not favor Iranian vaccines over foreign counterparts, and the priority is to start the nationwide vaccination campaign as soon as possible.
Now that the Coviran vaccine has proved safe for mass vaccination, the next step is to test its efficacy. Experts say this will be made clear in the second phase of the human trial, which will kickstart in almost a month. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinian refugees in the blockaded Gaza Strip demonstrated in front of UNRWA aid distribution centers against cuts to vital services and assistance by the UN agency. UNRWA provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem al-Quds, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. As of Sunday, UNRWA implemented further aid cuts to Palestinian refugees, citing budget deficit, but Palestinians maintain that cuts are merely political.
These cuts are purely political and have nothing to do with a budget deficit. Palestinian refugees will continue to fight these conspiracies against the Palestinians and their rights until we achieve the right of return. UNRWA must stop these measures that aim to undermine the issue of refugees and the Palestinian cause.
The Israeli regime has been campaigning to defund the UN agency in an attempt to end the refugees' right of return. The crisis deepened after former US President Donald Trump decided to cancel funding to UNRWA in 2018.
UNRWA has been cutting back its services over the years. What they gave us today is not enough to feed our families. Every time we get less food items. Today they gave me a small bag of sugar, which is barely enough to make tea for a few days. We are extremely poor and we want UNRWA to restore all of our food aid in order for us to survive.
The vast majority of Gazans are refugees who were kicked out of their towns and villages upon the establishment of the Israeli regime in 1948. Palestinian refugees who suffered for more than seven decades say UNRWA cuts will only increase their plight amid the coronavirus pandemic.
The cuts come at a time that Palestinian refugees are suffering the worst humanitarian conditions because of the COVID-19 pandemic. UNRWA must increase aid instead of cutting it. Palestinian refugees in the Gaza Strip are extremely poor and are the worst hit by these cuts.
Over 1.3 million Palestinian refugees live in the Gaza Strip, and their hardships have increased under the Israeli blockade.
Palestinian refugees say that as long as they are displaced and dispossessed, UNRWA should provide them with all due services without any cuts. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held a press conference aimed at expressing their refusal of the recent normalization of ties with Israeli regime. The conference comes as a code of ethics for Palestinian journalists and media institutes to stress their rejection for normalizing ties with Israel.
We condemn the recent normalization of ties with Israel. We held this conference as a code of ethics for journalists and media institutes to reveal the Israeli violations and normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. The normalization of ties remains a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
A number of Palestinian leaders, activists, and journalists attended the conference and condemned establishing Israeli relations, stressing that no deal can bring peace to Israel in the West Asia. Palestinian journalists and activists added that media has a significant role in conveying the true image of the inhumane Israeli regime and refused any normalization of ties with Israel in terms of media.
Normalizing ties with Israel is a way to justify the inhumane nature of Israel. The recent normalization of ties with Israel is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause, and we won't accept any recognition of Israel at the expense of Palestinians.
Palestinians call on Arab and Muslim nations to end these normalization of ties with Israel that aims to demolish the historical Palestinian cause.
Palestinian activists are all united to say that normalization of ties with Israel is a betrayal of all Palestinians. Media should stand against these attempts to demolish the Palestinian cause. All Arabs and Muslims should stop recognizing Israel as a state.
So far, a number of Arab states have normalized their ties with Israel, including the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. The move has sparked harsh criticism among the Muslim nations.
Palestinians here stress they strongly refuse to recognize Israel and reject the normalization of ties with the Tel Aviv regime by certain countries. They say the resistance is ongoing and no deal can bring peace to Israel at the expense of Palestinians. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The average student in the United States today leaves college with $37,000 of debt from student loans. University tuition has risen 1,200% since the late 1970s. Those younger than 24, called Generation Z, face the same prospect of expensive higher education combined with national economic stagnation since 2008. While on the campaign trail, Democrats raised major hopes with talk of an executive order canceling up to $50,000 in student debt. But President Joe Biden just declared, quote, "I will not make that happen," and he will only consider $10,000 in debt relief.
Student debt is parasitic. It's very right-wing. Joe Biden isn't centrist. He's right-wing. He's always been right-wing. If this person said that he had the capability to do it, which he does, and he said he does, and he's not going to do it because it sets the wrong precedent, then you're going to have a bunch of angry people.
Such huge amounts of debt has forced the millennial class to often delay mature steps, like buying a house, investing, pursuing a graduate degree, marriage, and children. That all depresses the economy, creates more social instability and disharmony, and all the while, economic inequality skyrockets in favor of the moneylenders.
I have $28,000 in student debt. Under capitalism, like, college can be a very predatory thing. You're betting the rest of your life to, like, being able to make these payments. And this is going to create more distrust for the Democrats. This is going to embolden more people that might be Republican that also have a lot of student debt to not trust this person.
The student debt crisis is seemingly a uniquely American issue, but 45 million Americans owe almost $2 trillion in student debt. The immense scope of the problem seems to ensure that the nation's young adults will keep this issue in the limelight for years, or maybe even decades, until either debt relief is granted or wages massively rise. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The scramble for vaccines has exposed global inequality yet again. Rich economies, including the US, EU, and the UK, have collectively secured more than double the amount they need, 3 billion doses, and administered 75% of the vaccines actually in existence. But in dozens of countries, no one has been vaccinated.
We are more than a little bit concerned that there is or is to be hoarding and price gouging, as well as undue preference in some quarters. This being so, we at CARICOM have recently called upon WHO to immediately convene an international convention of the world's people's representatives to commiserate, explain, assist, and commit to a fair sharing of the available vaccine resources for the benefit of all humankind and not just the privileged, well-heeled few.
Accused of hoarding, world leaders at the G7 summit Friday tried to stave off criticism by making more pledges. The UK has boasted about leading the world out of the pandemic, but Boris Johnson says the UK comes first, and spare doses will only be given away once all British adults have got the jab. The projection for that is July. US President Joe Biden also used the G7 summit, his first international meeting, to redeem Washington's reputation as the largest contributor to organizations like the World Health Organization. Geopolitics is at play here. Russia and China have emerged as major vaccine suppliers, but the EU has been accused of failing to execute a fair and even rollout, forcing nations to look elsewhere for supplies. China and Russia have already shipped tens of thousands of doses of their COVID-19 vaccine to developing and underdeveloped countries as well. Meanwhile, the US has stopped short of donating from its own massive supply. Amnesty International says rich countries do themselves no favors by hoarding. In the end, if not enough people are immunized, the virus will have free range to mutate and outsmart the vaccines. Bianca Rahimi, London.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the midst of a national shortage of N95 masks, the US government quietly granted an exception to its export ban on protective gear, allowing as many as 5 million of the masks per month to be shipped overseas. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Christina Jewett, correspondent at Kaiser Health News. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Workers Cried Out for More Masks. The government allowed N95 exports anyway. Here's more. In the midst of a national shortage of N95 masks, the US government quietly granted an exception to its export ban on protective gear, allowing as many as 5 million of the masks per month to be shipped overseas. The Federal Emergency Management Agency issued the waiver in the final moments of Donald Trump's presidency last month, allowing a Texas company to export its products after it failed to secure U.S. customers, according to FEMA letter obtained by KHN. National Nurses United President Zanny Trunfo-Cortez called the export waiver unconscionable and said N95s remain under lock and key in many hospitals. She said she still has to beg for a new N95 if hers gets soiled during a shift caring for COVID-19 patients. Healthcare employers and a federal agency that is supposed to be protecting the people of America are not doing their jobs, she said. They have no regard for American people's safety. The disconnect between frontline workers going without better protection and federal officials suddenly exporting masks boils down to one thing, workplace safety experts say. The government has not pivoted quickly enough to lift supply chain crisis mode guidelines and force employers to take costly and sometimes cumbersome steps to better protect workers with top quality gear. The FEMA letter references the challenge that Fort Worth-based Prestige Ameritech faced in finding customers for its government-approved high-end respirators. Hospitals did not want to fit test employees to its N95s, a 15-minute process per employee to ensure that a new N95 model seals to the face, according to company president Mike Bowen. Bowen said he ramped up N95 production during the pandemic from 75,000 to 9.6 million per month. Lately, he said he can't sell them to major buyers, does not have the infrastructure to sell them to small buyers, and has so many in storage that he may need to lay off workers and wind down production. The FEMA letter references those challenges and says the waiver was granted in the national defense interest to ensure he keeps production running at pace. The letter was transmitted to Border Patrol officials who oversee exports 103 minutes before Joe Biden was sworn into office. Yet even with the waiver, Bowen said he hasn't been able to find an overseas buyer. He said he can't understand the contradictory information he is getting. Frontline workers say they need more N95s, but hospitals say they don't. There is a disconnect someplace, and I don't know where it is, Bowen said. Why aren't my phones ringing off the hook if there is a shortage? A FEMA official said by email that the waiver could be revoked at any time if U.S. demand increases and that the agency could require the company to satisfy domestic demand before exporting N95s. Although prices fall considerably for those buying in bulk, prices for smaller lots of N95s have reached $4 to $7 each, according to Getas PPE, a nonprofit meant to match frontline workers with needed gear. The requirement for employers to perform fit tests annually was set aside amid the public health emergency, giving employers little incentive to veer from the industry standard models like 3M that were used for years. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has left guidelines in place that say a limited cadre of health care workers should get N95s, which can be reused and rationed. That adds up to an unusual situation in which U.S. mask supplies have surged, but employers' motivation to buy the best protective gear has not, said Peg Seminario, a former union health and safety official who recently signed a letter urging the CDC to update its guidelines to reflect the risk of inhaling the virus. "This is crazy," she said. "We could crush this pandemic where the biggest risks of infection are, and we are not doing it." Started by a group of emergency room doctors in March, Getas PPE said it gets 89% of requests for gear of an N95s from health workers outside of hospitals like community clinics, COVID testing sites, and psychiatric care facilities. Demand rose throughout January with 28% of frontline workers seeking N95s reporting that their site had none. Yet the volunteer-run group has been able to fulfill only about 15% of the requests it receives. Dr. Ali Raja, a founder of the group and executive vice chair of the emergency department at Massachusetts General Hospital, said, "The need is vast outside of hospitals, but a small facilities scrambling for gear are not connecting to bulk sellers like Bowen's firm. There was nothing out there, no centralized place for all facilities to best data on this. We want that to be the federal government." On the last day of 2020, FEMA extended its rule prohibiting anyone from exporting PPE, including N95s, without first getting express approval from the agency. The rule says the fall and winter surge in COVID cases meant domestic supply of allocated PPE has not kept pace with demand and is not anticipated to do so. The U.S. Strategic National Stockpile has not yet met its goal for N95 respirators, according to a U.S. Government Accountability Office report. The report said that as of December 18th, there were 190 million N95 respirators in storage, well short of its goal of 300 million. GAO remains deeply troubled that agencies have not acted on recommendations to more fully address critical gaps in the medical supply chain, the government watchdog report says. Another twist to the saga is that millions of counterfeit N95s stamped 3M, an industry standard that has long been used in previously required annual fit tests, have flooded hospital shelves even as federal agents rush to seize them at U.S. ports. A prominent group of scientists wrote to the CDC recently to point out guidelines that urgently need to be changed to protect workers from inhaling tiny airborne virus particles. Their letter noted that the CDC does not recommend the use of N95 respirators outside healthcare settings, even though outsized risks are documented for bus drivers, prison guards, and meatpacking staffers. CDC guidelines also allow hospitals to limit which workers get the N95s, leaving out those in community setting and lower-level workers who typically spend the most time next to patients. In the Loss on the Frontline project, KHN and The Guardian have documented the deaths of hundreds of more than 3,440 frontline health workers, of whom 2 in 3 were workers of color and 56% worked outside of hospitals. For more than 120 who died, family members had concerns about PPE, including the extensive reuse of N95s or the use of surgical masks for direct care of COVID patients.
Greetings and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has stressed in his recent speech that the Islamic Republic is not seeking nukes, while at the same time it won't dispense with the nation's right to utilize peaceful nuclear energy. He also reminded the fact that Iran believes in the slogan, nuclear energy for all, nuclear bombs for no one. Ayatollah Khamenei says that Iran would have nuclear weapons today if it had wished to have them. He stressed that it's the Islamic ideology that bans all forms of mass destruction weapons. Now the question is, if the West is really concerned about Tehran accessing nukes, why did they not stick to the 2015 nuclear deal? The U.S. even scrapped it altogether. Now we'll watch a report and then discuss the issue.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed what he called the arrogant, high-handed, unjust, and erroneous rhetoric of the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal toward the Islamic Republic. Ayatollah Khamenei also denounced Britain, France, and Germany for failing to comply with their commitments under the nuclear agreement. The leader also lashed out at Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has repeatedly accused Iran of trying to acquire nuclear weapons. The leader added that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure and will not back down on its logical stance on its nuclear program. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei referred to a law passed by the Iranian parliament in late December that requires the government to take additional action to reduce commitments to the nuclear deal, which includes a decision to end the voluntary implementation of additional protocol. The leader said Iran will develop its nuclear capabilities in line with the needs of the country, and for this reason, Iran's enrichment purity level will not be limited to 20%. He said Tehran may increase the level to 60% if it deems necessary.
We should remember that the framework around this whole thing here is that a number of nuclear powers are sitting telling what Iran should do, which is not a nuclear power, while other nuclear powers are not even discussed.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear agreement and its reimposition of sanctions in May 2018, Tehran exercised patience and remained fully committed to its obligations under the accord. However, a year later, Iran started to reduce its commitments in 5 gradual steps every 60 days, citing the failure of the European signatories to the JCPOA to uphold their end of the deal. In the meantime, Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, said on Monday that Tehran has terminated the voluntary implementation of additional protocol which allowed snap inspections of Iranian nuclear sites. On Sunday, Iran and the UN nuclear watchdog reached an agreement for the continued inspection of Iranian nuclear sites for 3 months. Gharibabadi said Iran would record information at certain nuclear facilities without the supervision of the inspectors as per the new agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has recently expressed willingness to participate in an informal JCPOA meeting with Iran and other signatories. It has offered to hold talks with Iran over how to return to the deal. This is why Iranian officials have repeatedly and unequivocally rejected any preconditions or talks on the U.S. return to the deal, arguing that it was the U.S. that abandoned the accord and violated the U.N. Security Council 2231 that endorsed the multilateral agreement. Tehran says it will reverse its scalebacks to its commitments under the deal once all sanctions are lifted and all the signatories go back to full compliance.
Now, that was the report. Now, let me invite our guests to this debate show. We have Director of Risale at the Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Mehdi Torabi, joining us out of the Iranian city of Qom, and also a journalist and political commentator, Said Mohsen Abbas, out of London. Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Let's go to Qom. Sam, world powers reached a nuclear deal with Iran after marathon negotiations, and then when it came to implementation, the U.S. left it altogether, while Iran remained in full compliance for more than a year, as you know. So in what context do you assess Washington's departure from what Europeans call a landmark accord?
Well, Berzan, we've talked about this many times before. There was an attempt over 30 years by elites in Iran to so-called normalize relations, normalize economic relations with the West. We even heard this in the interview that Dr. Zarif had with Press TV a couple of days ago, that he mentioned three goals. Out of the JCPOA, he said, making the enrichment, Iranian enrichment official under international law, ending Iran's securitization, and the final goal was to normalize economic relations. Well, this is something that did not happen in reality, and it was never going to happen. The point is that there was a belief among Iranian elites, many of them, not all of them, that there could be something called normal economic relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the West, not understanding that the relations between Iran and the West over the last 200, 300 years have been predatory. So there's no such thing for the West as normal relations. So we've now come to this end of this process after 20, 30 years. We made our best effort. The whole world saw that Iran is willing to give up part of its strategic capabilities, in this case, as it relates to nuclear technology, for this thing that was called normal economic relations, which, again, as I mentioned, is something that was never really going to happen. And this process now has come to an end. It failed on the ground, and the Americans were never going to, whether it was Obama or Trump or Biden or whoever else might come in the future, were ever going to establish normal economic relations with Iran.
Okay, now let me turn to London. Said Mohsen Abbas, Tehran is saying that it could have nukes if it wanted to, as I mentioned in intro. But the thing is that even if we want to move in that direction, Islam won't allow it. So on what ground is the West crying wolf when it comes to Iran's nuclear activity?
It's crying wolf on the ground that they're under instructions, essentially, from forces behind the scenes. One of those forces is obviously Israel. The other one, arguably, is the moneylender mafia, which pretty much controls the economic and military and political gain globally. The fact of the matter is that these guys, like Biden or Netanyahu, are ultimately just puppets and levers of power, if you like. So, to be honest, these guys are the messengers. They deliver the message which the global powers that be want implemented. The problem for them is that the Islamic Republic of Iran is one of the only nations now left that isn't part of the Bank of International Settlements, not part of that, if you like, control mechanism that they want. It doesn't comply with the values and the ethics and the morality, whatever that is. I mean, in fact, it's a non-existent morality. And Ayatollah Khamenei re-emphasizing his religious commitment to not having nuclear weapons is significant for a Muslim or for somebody who understands morality. It has no significance for these folk because they don't have any intention of being truthful in any policy that they roll out. All of their policies are based on economic, if you like, priorities, which will always, always, always trump ethics and morality. So you're dealing with an essentially immoral beast, and Imam Khamenei knows this. Just give you an example. Earlier this month, French President Emmanuel Macron pitched himself as an honest broker between the Biden administration and Tehran. But he also insisted that the countries such as Israel and Saudi Arabia should be involved in talks. You know, as if Israel and Saudi Arabia are some sort of neutral party, and as if Israel isn't already violating the nuclear, if you like, situation globally. It's accountable to nobody. Over 400 nuclear weapons pointed probably mainly at Iran, and it's continuously causing trouble. Saudi Arabia is its kind of clandestine puppet as well. This is the problem. This is the insight which the assembly of experts today, who Imam Khamenei addressed, knows. They've managed to keep imperialism off the soil of Iran since the revolution. That is going to stick in the gullet of the powers that be, and they will not really abide by any agreement. You've seen it already collapse once. What's to say that when Biden goes out of power, even if he were to agree to something with Iran now, which is highly, highly unlikely, what's to say that they won't just renege on their deals? They're known for it. It's a common practice.
Right. Now, Sam, Iran's nuclear activity has undergone the largest number of international inspections, multiple reports put forward by the IAEA, all confirming the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear activity. Tehran has not benefited from the nuclear deal, but still allows the IAEA inspections to go on, except for that voluntary part of the initial protocol. Isn't this indicative of Iran's goodwill?
Of course it is. And again, we have to remember a couple of things here, Behrouz. One is that everything that Iran has been doing is completely legal under international law, is now, by the law that was passed by the Majlis, incumbent and obligatory on the executive branch to fulfill it. So as far as legally and morally, I think we don't need to keep repeating that Iran has the moral high ground, that Iran has the right. We need to get beyond this. This is a fact. It's established. Everybody knows it. The only problem is that countries like the European countries, which, you know, claim to be very civilized and sophisticated, but the reality is that they do not dare to speak against the country that won World War II and has been occupying them for 70 years. This is the reality of Europe. And I go back that all of this discussion goes back to an incorrect understanding among some Iranian elites of the realities that exist in the world. They thought that they could have a thing called normal relations with the West. This basically does not exist. There is no such thing as normal relations with Western powers. There's no such thing as normal relations with America. So there was an attempt by certain Iranian elites after the war, around the personality of the late Ayatollah Hashemi Rafsanjani, to get this thing going. They've been trying it for 20 years. Everybody, including the Supreme Leader, has said, fine, go do it, let's see what happens. It is now, we have now experienced this on the ground empirically, that it's not going to happen. And of course, the biggest problem with this understanding is that there might have been some way of justifying this understanding 30 years ago, 1990, 1989, 1991, that there was only, you know, the West or America. But the world in 2020, 2021 is very different than 1990. There's a lot of other economic powers in the world which Iran can cooperate with. And the most important thing is that Iran itself has much more powerful and much more economically capable than it was 30 years ago. But unfortunately, these elites were able to have the policy decision-making in the country in a way control it, or in a way influence it, that allowed them greater power than the reality of what was on the ground. So now, all of this has happened, Iran has shown its good faith internationally. Right. Iran has allowed the democratic processes within Iran to take shape. Governments get elected, get reelected, new governments come into play, the people decide what they want to do, and so this process has now come to its natural end. It's very unlikely that this administration is going to end this process because this is all they had to offer in these 8 years when they came. So probably what will happen is that in the beginning of the summer, when we have a new administration in Iran, this process is going to end in a more official and in a more significant way than we see it today.
Okay. Now, Said Mohsen, the Islamic Republic regards use of weapons of mass destruction an unforgivable sin. So to that, it's even raised this initiative called the Middle East Free from Chemical Weapons. What Iran insists to continue is the peaceful use of nuclear energy. Every country is right. So what's wrong with that?
I think it's a fantastic initiative, and I think that this is where the Islamic Republic of Iran has to back from. They've got to stop, as my colleague was saying, stop looking to the West for frameworks, for solutions, for ideas, not be bedazzled by the technical advancement or the kind of military advancements they've had over the last century or two or longer, and actually start turning, as they are doing, internally to their own source of intellectual and creative, if you like, advancement. And I think that part of that, quality that the Iranians do have, it's something that they need to acknowledge to themselves, is that they have a moral infrastructure, a framework which can build these kinds of ideas. You know, give the world solutions to the problems which neo-capitalism, neoliberalism, hyper-capitalism of the West has gifted us with. Look, we're facing a world where an economic reset, a global economic reset, is being engineered by those very powers which have raped and pillaged not only the East, far more the East and Africa and that part of the globe, but they've also been subjugating and, if you like, controlling the people in the West with all sorts of amazingly destructive notions, like, for instance, their ideas around, for instance, feminism. We could put other things on the table that are there in terms of gender fluidity, the whole moral morass, which is picked up here. All of this has been gifted by the powers that be that are pushing out these ideologies. How long, if these elites, which my colleague talked about, do constantly look to the West for some sort of direction as to where Iran should go, or in terms of following their lead on this JCPOA or following their lead on other matters? Well, to be honest with you, I think you're looking at a sort of an empire in recession, in collapse, and it really is a credit to Iran that even in this economic, if you like, terrorism phase that we've seen, especially over the last decade, rolled out against Iran, what's Iran done? There are more university students coming out of those universities, which wasn't existent under Shah, for instance. There are more accelerations in aerospace technology. There's been an advancement in moving away from oil and reliance on gas only to actually using the resources of Iran on a wider field. This self-sustainability, this turning more to the East, if you're going to look for any backup, is the way forward. And I think that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I'm afraid the Western system is fundamentally opposed not only to Iran, it's opposed to its Islamic revolutionary ideology. It's opposed to the morality that revolution potentially stands for, and it doesn't want any of that to be, if you like, filtered into the rest of the globe. So therefore, it's obliged to try and do everything it can to destroy Iran, trying to make a friend out of a wolf for any animal that actually is on its dinner menu is naive and foolish.
Right. Okay, Sam, the United States, as you know, possesses the largest arsenal of lethal and mass destruction weapons. It's even used them against other countries. So how can it expand its nuclear arsenal at the same time expect others to get rid of them?
Well, like I said, I mean, these discussions are, you know, something that are so basic and elementary, I don't think we need to waste our time on these issues. The reality is that it's not about international law. It's not about you know, agreements and so on and so forth. I mean, yes, they have a certain place, maybe as a marginal issue. The whole UN system is a tool, as the Westerners see the UN system and the Americans see the UN system as a tool of, you know, expanding their own power and projecting their own power. So I think this is a problem that some of the people in Iran have, is that they actually believe the things that they read in the books in terms of international relations and international law. I mean, it's very different, the reality of what the world is, from what it is in the books. International law is a very narrow concept, and it is used and seen by Western powers as a tool of their own power. So there's no point in us trying to really, you know, look at this as a way of salvation or trying a way to figure out how the world we're going to govern that. I understand Dr. Zarif as an international lawyer making narrow arguments under international law. I understand that. Mm-hmm. This is something that, as an academic, I get it. But this is a very different issue than what the reality of the politics of the world is. Yes, it's true. According to the, you know, UN resolution, Iran now officially can enrich. But why do we even have to go there? Why did we even have to go into that position where, you know, that we have to say that this is a victory? I believe that this is changing the goalposts after the facts.
Okay.
The goal of the JCPOA, as stated by the Supreme Leader, was getting rid of the sanctions on Iran. It has not happened, and it will never happen under the JCPOA.
Okay.
The whole point of the JCPOA was to create a framework for Iran and the West to talk, so that the West could start talking about Iran's strategic military capabilities, such as missiles and nuclear energy and other things, and whatever else it wants to add in the future.
Okay.
Well, we tried it. We showed good faith. We were even willing to compromise for a certain amount of time on our strategic capabilities. It did not happen. Let's move on.
Okay, good. Now, Said Muslim, one last question. We have very little time for that. Recently, we have had satellite images showing even further activity at the Dimona nuclear facility used by the Tel Aviv regime. Who's posing a threat to regional peace?
Well, if you want to look at the Yinon plan, which Israel has been working on ever since the 60s and perhaps even before that, if you want to look at the number of U.S. bases that are dotted around all around the Middle East, and particularly now lining up all around the Islamic Republic of Iran, if you want to look at the interference in Syria and of British and American forces prior to the war that was initiated by themselves, if you want to look at ISIS and Daesh and the inability to finish them off completely, that's just the tip of the iceberg. If you want to look at Iraq and its kind of, if you like, total decimation and destruction, all roads lead to Tel Aviv and Washington, D.C. There are no other routes. The rest of them, the London, the German capitals, they are like tails of a dog, and they wag according to whatever the main beast wants. So
I've got to jump in. I'm sorry. That's all the time we have. Thank you very much for your comments. We had Director of Risala, the Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Mehtotrabi from Qom, and journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas out of London. And thank you for watching this debate.